There was this spoken word essay I heard at some point. It was many years ago, maybe decades, and it was otherwise unmemorable to me, except for this one line that got burned into my brain for some reason. You know how that happens. It was, "The real troubles in your life are apt to be things that never crossed your worried mind. The kind that blindsides you at 4 p.m. some idle Tuesday."
Your life are apt to be things that never crossed your worried mind. The kind that blindsides you at 4 p.m. on
idle Tuesday, 11 a.m. Phone buzzes, peek between meetings. Group message. "Dad's in the hospital. I'd come here if you can." It was lung cancer, very advanced, blindside. 3 weeks later, the morning of my 38th birthday, I walked into a hospital room. Though his prognosis was grim, he'd seemed like himself just a few days before. We'd been flipping through the hospital TV. Over the constant beeping of the medical equipment, I'd ask about his hospital lunch. It was macaroni. But today, this morning, he's asleep, except breathing heavily, visibly, very labored. He's not waking up. Watching a loved one die, it's kind of a mysterious thing, which, when you think about it, just makes no sense, because it's a universal experience, cross-cultural. We'll all experience it sooner or later, yet we don't talk about it. We don't connect about it. And we could. We spend so much time talking about things we disagree on. Why? For this piece, you'll hear my own experience processing and healing after my dad's death. I worked with a grief counselor, Bailey Chilman, on this work, and I recorded it. You'll hear how it went. I'm Tobin Richardson, a counselor educator with a vision to save the therapist by creating a forever free podcast-style platform designed for learning. And here, dying, death, grief. Let's talk about it. I met Bailey in her office, right off a busy intersection near the interstate. I'd explained to her in detail what I wanted to do, this unique type of consultation where I could learn about the techniques she administered in her grief work firsthand by applying them to me, my life. It had been 5 months since that Tuesday. I wasn't consumed by it anymore. My life had continued on. I kept busy. But I was having dreams about my dad often, something I had dreaded. I hadn't looked back at his texts or listened to his voicemails, other things I was scared of. Bailey's an art therapist. One of the things that caught my attention in her Psychology Today profile, which was the way I found her, I've almost never incorporated art into my own clinical work with clients, but something about grief work made it seem intriguing to me. In this role on the other side of the table, I think it felt less intimidating, almost warm and welcoming rather than daunting. I found out later from Bailey that I'm unique in this way. Many men struggle with the thought of applying art to their grief, which is something that now I both don't get and still totally get. I'm going to cut to some of our very first meeting, just getting rolling, telling Bailey more about myself.
But about
what brought you in today?
Okay. So my dad passed away. In like probably the past 5 months, I've just not let myself think about it. You know, it's just been like distracting myself constantly. Probably like a couple months ago, I was like, I've got to figure out ways to talk about this in an intentional way.
Later in this first meeting, Bailey started to explain to me her philosophy of applying art therapy in her grief work she facilitates.
As part of the grief process, one of the first things that I like to do with people is have a holding space for that. And so what I really like to do is create that physical space. So kind of like a memory box. Or a legacy box. Usually, I'm an art therapist, and usually I have tons of shoe boxes because shoe boxes contain. It's a natural container. And so I'll probably have you pick out a shoe box today, and I'll have you decorate it. You know, you can decorate the inside, the outside. This will be kind of like a holding space for your memories. You can always bring it in. We can go through what you've put in it. It's also can be a place for holding memorabilia. So pictures, letters, anything like that you want to.
Okay.
So, and then that's nice, a nice jumping start and a talking point.
Yeah.
If you happen to want to do those things, you don't have to, but kind of processing those things might be a little bit easier with those things in there next time.
Yeah. That makes a lot of sense. Okay.
Yeah. All right. Awesome. Are you ready to get started?
Yeah, let's do it.
All right. So I've got different size boxes.
Okay.
We range from the littles to more bigger. You can choose your medium. So the outside of that box is kind of shiny and slick. So acrylic paint would work if you wanted to paint it. You could also glue or tape paper. So construction paper or regular paper.
We went on to start building out this memorabilia box. With a shoebox in front of me, I started cutting paper, taping it on top. I don't think of myself as artsy, so doing something like this felt a little outside my wheelhouse. It's been a while, like probably since childhood, since I've embarked on a project like this. And it was kind of a nice distraction from the type of conversation I knew was coming. I think Bailey could sense my hesitation to move my focus away from the task in front of me. She was patient, and then she asked a simple question. We talked about it later. She said, "What was your dad's name?" "Mike," I said. "Michael. It's my middle name." And then went on to tell her all the other things my dad and I had in common. He taught psychology, I told her, at the high school I went to. It was one of the things we both were interested in, and I think we both loved having that connection. Unlike me, he had this big, booming presence. Sometimes when he'd get especially irritated, he'd kick the trash can across the classroom. His face was beet red, and he'd storm out cursing. In our rural high school, tucked between three cornfields, it was totally acceptable. Nobody ever questioned it. Sometimes I thought he did it just for the show of it, to keep everyone on their toes. And if so, it worked. Everyone loved him. But something about the project, the task on the table, it helped me to talk about it all. It was a less direct way to jump into a topic I'd purposely been trying to avoid. I could look down at the yellow paper and scissors and talk. It was nice. Cutting now to a different day, our conversation continuing.
How are your dreams? Have you guys still had dreams?
Yeah, I have still been having them. Kind of the same, like just... I think I had a dream, the most recent one was like, I just had a dream that he was saying that he wasn't scared of dying. Yeah. So I don't know where that came from.
Did he say that when he was alive?
No.
No. Okay.
No. I mean, he talked about dying all the time. He never really said he was or wasn't scared about it. I don't know. He just said he was going to, you mm-hmm. know, soon. Mm-hmm. And I don't know. There's so many, you know, just like as someone's dying, there's a lot of intense moments where you're mm-hmm. like, what are they thinking right now? You mm-hmm. know, like, anyways. So maybe it was had something to do from that.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I guess maybe I kind of wanted Tim to say that or something.
Yeah, could be.
Yeah. I mean,
it could be your subconscious telling you that you know, this has happened, and maybe, you know, you wanting to know, like, he is okay from that, or maybe that's what you wanted him to say. It's hard to tell. But do you feel like would you consider that a bad dream?
No, it wasn't really like a nightmare or anything.
Okay.
Mm-mm.
Okay. If you could continue that dream and have it have a not that it's a bad dream, but have a happier or more soft or calm, wrapped up feeling, what do you feel like he would say, or what would you do in that dream to kind of wrap that up and make it feel less like, oh, he's here again saying the same thing?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I just have a lot of questions are like I wasn't there when he died, you know, like it was like in the middle of the night, and none of us were there. And I was there earlier in that day, but I think I would have just said, like, I wish it could have gotten more into, like, do you wish that I would have stayed there with you? I just think about that, like, I think he probably knew that I was there because he kept coughing, like, when we'd leave the room. And he pretty much, like, you know, he wasn't really... It was weird because I didn't know, like, when you're in that in-between where they're telling you they're going to die, but then you see them three times around, they're fine. Like, you saw that picture. Mm-hmm. That was totally just him. I just had no idea. So I went there on the morning of my birthday, and he was just, you know, just very labored breathing. Just in my typical fashion, I just kind of was ignoring it. You know, I was kind of just pretending he was asleep or something. And it's kind of embarrassing thinking back at it because, you know, the medical staff don't want to tell you he's dying, but they hint at it. So they had, like, the palliative care nurse had stopped me and said, we're going to put him on a continuous dose of pain medicine. I know it's really hard to see him like that. And I said, is that going to mean he's not going to have any cognitive abilities or anything like that? And I just, thinking back now, she's saying, like, he doesn't. Were you not just in there? But I just couldn't accept it, you know? And so I just said, Dad, we're leaving. Like, you know, then he coughed when I was leaving. And it just wasn't very good goodbye, you know?
Right. And I think nobody knows when somebody's going to die. Not one person. Not even those nurses. They might have been able to say, yeah, we think within 48 hours or 24 hours, right? But nobody knows the exact moment. And so it's impossible for you to say, okay, he might have lived another 24. You might have been able to come back. Nobody knows that.
I mean, I did kind of know.
Yeah.
I don't know. I just couldn't bring myself to do it. And I don't know. And when I left, I just texted my family, like my siblings, and I said that. Like, I said, they're going to put Dad on a constant dose of, you know, I didn't even want to say it to them. I just think in a different situation, had the dynamics been different or had I, like, been able to face it? And I'm like, would we all have went back again? It's just very hard for everybody to get there at the same time. I don't know. Maybe it doesn't matter. Like, anyways, it's just... So, I guess to get back to your original question, how do I wish that would have turned out? I wish he would have said, there's no reason... Like, you guys came the right times. Like, I don't know. I just think about the fact that he was dying there in a hospital in Indianapolis. He wasn't even from here. His whole life was in our hometown. Everybody knew him there. With nurses that didn't know him. And I don't know. I wonder how much he thought, like, this is how I'm going to die. And, like, my family's not even here.
Well, and I also wonder, too, if in your dream... There's lots of people who believe in a lot of different things, but was his cough what he would have said maybe in your dream? Like, I'm not afraid. I'm okay. Thank you for being here. Like, I think it could have went a lot of different ways, and nobody really knows, right? But there's this cool project that I like to do with people that when they have dreams in general, they can be bad dreams or good dreams. Like having a phrase or a picture, using a pillowcase.
Okay.
So we'll use a pillowcase if you want. This is just a pitch of an idea.
Yeah, yeah.
A pillowcase, and we've got fabric paint, and we create an image or have a saying with an image or just a saying of what might help you. Maybe like if you wake up from that dream and like you can look at that, it's glow in the dark paint too. So yeah, it glows in the dark at night. Maybe it's an image of a sun, or maybe it's an image of a moon, or maybe it's an image of something that might remind you of like when you wake up from that dream and you can say to yourself, this is how that's ending for me in this dream. Like, yeah, he is okay. He wasn't afraid to die. He keeps telling you that in his dream, and so in your dream. And so I keep wondering if that's something that, like, that's the way you're wrapping it up in your head.
Yeah.
And I think that's a really positive thing.
Yeah.
But I wonder if that would be something you would be interested in doing to see if.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, I think so. I love. It was kind of a light bulb for me that maybe he was saying something, that maybe that cough was something positive. I just always assumed it was kind of like, don't leave, I'm dying. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense to me, because I do feel a little bit stuck. Like, yeah, I don't even want to stop dreaming about it necessarily, which is a weird thing to say because I was scared about it at first.
Mm-hmm.
I just want to, I don't know, feel a little bit more resolved. Like,
yeah.
One of the more interesting parts of this whole experience was that Bailey and I got to chat about this work we did together afterwards, clinician to clinician. And when we did, it helped me to see that a lot of the goals she has for her grief work don't necessarily require art therapy. She incorporates art because it's her thing and she knows how to do it well and it usually feels right. But the goals she had were in many ways ones we've heard about before and we strive for always. Things like validation of feelings and creating a space that feels safe. She did talk about how it can be helpful in grief work to really understand the grieving process. Things like common stages and patterns of grief. Although, of course, there's not one size fits all, and it's always going to be unique to the client. One of the things we talked about a lot was the importance of connection. The goal wasn't for me to let go. In some ways, it was the opposite. It was to continue to connect to my dad. And that reframe was really helpful for me. And I can see how a physical box works towards that goal. We also made some specific plans about things like when and what I wanted to do with my dad's ashes, how to make meaning of his legacy. One of the things I told Bailey was that I often felt this release after we talked. I just needed some gentle prompting to get there. And of course, my grief story was unique. I don't consider it to be complicated or prolonged in the clinical sense, which of course could play out really differently. When my dad taught introductory psychology, one of his signature moves early in the semester, he was known for it, is that he'd scream, "Wilhelm Wundt." Like the entire school heard it and everyone would laugh. And in case you need a refresher, Wilhelm Wundt was one of the early psychologists who applied the scientific method to the study of the human mind. He wanted to know what was observable and measurable before those types of practices were thought to be a good way to make sense of us as people. I'll never get to ask my dad what he wanted from me on that day when I walked out of his hospital room. I've lost the chance of collecting measurable data. But when I was walking out of Bailey's office, I looked up into the sky and I really sensed how big and expansive it was. And I felt him there in a way that wasn't sad, it was comforting. It was the least scientific method I could possibly apply to understanding my healing. But I knew I'm going to be okay. Sorry, Wilhelm. Thanks, Dad. Up next, you'll hear from Emily Bierbauer, a therapist who, as a therapist, while she was already practicing, experienced what I think many of us would agree is the most intense type of loss, one that no one could be prepared for, that of her 11-year-old son. And then all of a sudden, she wasn't facilitating grief work, she was living it. And it taught her a lot, things she just didn't realize before about what it's like. She started regretting the things she'd said about death before. It made her cringe to think about. And it also brought up some unexpected questions about how she interacted with her clients. Here's her story.
I was wondering if if it's okay with you, if you kind of start off by like just telling us, like telling me about your son. I would love to hear like what he was interested in and what.
Sure.
Yeah.
So he was 11. His name was Bernardo, but he went by Bernie. And I adopted him when he was 6 from the Texas foster care system. So he, this kid had, you know, he had spina bifida and some other birth defects, but was healthy. But he was, I mean, had such a big presence and was not, you know, even remotely slowed down by, you know, his physical disabilities. Just the life of a party, happy-go-lucky kid who, you know, had all the reason in the world to be bitter and just was just a loving, sweet kid.
Do you feel like people now, 2.5 years later, are hesitant to bring up Bernie and talk about him? And if so, is that frustrating to you?
I mean, I love it when people bring him up. I love it when people find pictures on their phone or whatever. But are people hesitant to do that? I mean, yeah. Well, so that's actually an interesting thing that happens too with grief that I was talking to a friend about, which is the more time goes on, the more I meet people that have no idea that he existed. And so it becomes really hard to know when do you bring it up because it's so heavy and people don't know how to react. You know, we don't live in a society that talks about death at all. It's such a taboo topic. But I have found that it's hard to know when to bring it up to new people. So that's even weird when I take new clients, they ask about your family. You know, those are questions I would always answer. I'm not, you know, a blank slate. So how do you bring up this thing that makes you appear vulnerable and damaged when your role is to not be the vulnerable, damaged one, right? And to not flip it. And, you know, after he died, I had clients like Facebook find my meal train and like bring over lasagnas. And I had, you know, clients come to his funeral. And there was this, you know, I was deeply touched by it, but, you know, I'm at my very lowest, most vulnerable moment. And that's what they're seeing.
So what do you say? Like if you get a new client who says, do you have kids?
So I mean, I'll usually tell them, you know, that I have an 11-year-old, but I have a 21-year-old. And I do say two, and I'll say he's a, you know, and I won't normally be like, and he died, if it's not important. But it is, it's always hard to know how to answer. And even how old is he, you know, because he would be 13 now. So, but I have decided that if they ask explicitly, then I answer explicitly. It doesn't ever come out. Like people are like, oh, you'll figure it out eventually. And it'll be much easier to know what to say. And I'm not there yet. No matter what I say, doesn't feel quite right when people ask me that.
What do you think mental health professionals get wrong about grief?
So I will tell you, like everybody and their mom, like I swear the UPS guy was like, are you going to see a therapist? You feel like you have to because that's what you're supposed to do after this big trauma. But really kind of what you need is rest and grace, you know, with responsibilities and help with these little things. You know, you kind of just need to get through it and get focused. And I think if I had tried to get like therapy right after, it would have been harmful, at least in the initial period.
What do you think that's about? Do you think that's about, this is like the theory that's popping into my head. Do you think that's because they don't know how else to show you support? So they do this thing that's actually not at all helpful, but makes them.
Yeah, there's a lot of not at all helpful things. And especially when your child otherwise has a disability, he's running in heaven. Oh my gosh, I will kill you if you know. I think it's because it's just in the list of things people think they're supposed to say. Because we don't ever talk about grief and what's helpful. So we have this like people that say that are, they mean well, but it's such a common stupid thing to say because we don't ever talk about the right things to say because we don't ever talk about death.
As part of my research for this piece, one of the things I did was I reached out to therapist groups with a question. And the question was, if you yourself have experienced grief, what have you done to cope with it that worked? Anything creative? And one of the responses I got was from a therapist who said that after her husband of 23 years died, she started writing poetry, and it helped. And she said she hadn't shared these short poems in the years since, but would be happy to pass them along to me. And as I read them, even on my scuffed and scraped computer screen, I felt them, like the words were jumping off the screen. So I asked if she could record some of these poems and send them over to me. Here one is. Calm, written by Lisa Ellis, August 2022.
Calm. Fetal position. Arms overhead, begging for relief. Waves throw to and fro. Chaos, turmoil, death, complete darkness. Attempt to walk. Equilibrium decimated. Storm in control. Weather patterns change. Calmer waters emerge. Wary of new. Light dawns. Uncertain eyes fix on the horizon, waiting for the tempest. Truth also dawns. Horizon of darkness can also be horizon of beauty. Sunset. Sunrise. Calm seas. Trust the beauty. Waves will arise. Turmoil will be felt. Calm will return.
There are many theories and models of grief and grieving, some of which Bailey and I talked about. The most well-known is the five stages of grief theory, developed by Elizabeth Kubler-Ross. And these five stages include denial, anger, bargaining, depression, and acceptance. And Bailey said it can help to have these stages in the back of your mind, especially if you're struggling to understand where a client's at. But you should never think of these as a strict progression. It's not that simple, and it's way more individualized. Even Kubler-Ross has later clarified that the model is often misapplied. And as I think about these stages, I'm not sure how they applied to me and the grief of my dad. They don't really resonate with my experience. There are less known theories that apply to grief that might be worth looking into further if you're not yet all that familiar with this space. And one is called the continuing bonds theory, which says that maintaining a connection with the deceased loved one is natural, and it's often a healthy part of grieving, rather than something we should strive to let go of. It says our bonds evolve after the loss of a loved one, but they don't end. And I could feel Bailey working towards this type of continued bond through many of the techniques that she applied. Another model that really resonated with me was one called the dual process model of grief, which says that grieving oscillates between loss-oriented and recovery-oriented activities. Kind of like a pendulum that's swinging back and forth, where some days we feel waves of sadness, and other days we're feeling more back to ourselves, maybe even developing new routines or relationships. And to me, that feels right for my grief. And it helped me feel more validated in what has sometimes felt like abnormal ups and downs, which apparently aren't abnormal at all. But then again, what's normal anyways? Because we all know by now how vastly different our clients can present with any circumstance or any diagnosis. So, of course, that applies to grief. Handbook, no. But memory box, yes. Also, by the way, though the poem Calm was written by Lisa Ellis in 2022, she's now Lisa Titus. She got remarried in October.